Hello and welcome to Pittsburgh Liberation Radio. This is Nick here today with two incredible guests, Kareem and Ahmed. Kareem and Ahmed are Palestinian Americans and are both very active in the Pittsburgh-Palestine Solidarity Movement. Both have family in Gaza and have unfortunately lost many loved ones in Israel's genocidal assault on the Palestinian people. This genocide has been backed to the hilt by the Biden administration and an overwhelming majority of representatives and senators from both ruling class parties. As we approach the 100th day of the genocide in Gaza, the humanitarian crisis the Zionists have wrought is almost incomprehensible. Nearly 25,000 dead, 60,000 wounded, 85 to 90% of the people displaced. Homes, mosques, churches, and hospitals have been destroyed indiscriminately. As the resistance fights on and Israel escalates tensions across the region, we can't lose sight of just how dire the situation is for the civilians of Gaza. Just after October 7th, fascist war criminal Yoav Gallant, the minister of so-called defense in Israel, promised to implement a complete medieval-style siege on the already besieged population. He said, quote, "I have ordered a complete siege on the Gaza Strip. There will be no electricity, no food, no fuel. Everything is closed." Gallant and Israel's barbaric actions have led to what has been described by UN and human rights officials as the most dire humanitarian situation in the world right now. Starvation, dehydration, exposure, and a collapse of the medical system are killing Palestinians, the interminable bombing campaign aside. Now more than ever, it is absolutely crucial that we do everything we can to bring this genocide to an end and ensure that Gaza lives. Kareem and Ahmed are here today to tell us their stories, humanize the Palestinian people, and hopefully inspire you to action. With that, Kareem, Ahmed, thank you so much for joining us today on Pittsburgh Liberation Radio. And if you could please just start by introducing yourselves briefly and giving the audience some background on who you are and what your connection to Gaza is.
Kareem, if you'd like to go first.
Okay, thank you, Ahmed. Thank you for having us on the podcast, Nick. We appreciate it. I am Gazan, Palestinian. Grew up in Egypt, born in Kuwait, then grew up in Egypt, and then spent most of my life in Canada, now 11 years in Pittsburgh. So a little bit of an international perspective here. But my parents were both born in Palestine prior to 1948 to Nakba. My dad was born in Beer Sheba, which is Beer Seba in Arabic. And my mother was born in Gaza. Beer Sheba is probably about where he grew up, was about 50 kilometers away from Gaza. And my whole life, I just grew up hearing stories about Palestine because I wasn't born there, never stepped foot until 2019 in Palestine, but I haven't been to Gaza. And my father remembers it vividly, his experience in 1948, because he was about 7 or 8 years old at the time. Of course, we can go into more details, but I think that's what brings me here today, talk about those experiences.
Yeah, thank you for that. Ahmed?
Thanks, Nick, for having us. So my name is Ahmed. I was born in Gaza. Basically, at the age of maybe 7 or so, that's when the first intifada happened, and sort of remember, you know, the soldiers, the army, the bullets, the tear gas, the home invasions every night, all of these memories that are still with you, but it doesn't compare to anything to what we are seeing now. I still have family in Gaza. My parents are both born in 1948, Palestine. So they were born in what's the city's, and it used to be called Al-Lid, and it is called Al-Lid now as well. So that's where they come from. They immigrated or forced to leave their homes and basically moved to ultimately Gaza, And that's where we came from.
Yeah, thank you for that. Now, I do obviously want to get to what's going on currently, but I think you both touched on something common and very important in that, you know, your family's experiences inevitably have been touched by the Nakba, the catastrophe, right? And I think that's something that's very important for people to understand as they're analyzing the current situation today, just to simplify it a bit in that what's going on now just didn't spring out of nowhere. You know, on our side, we've been trying to do a lot of like educational events to explain this history so people can really root their understanding and fight accordingly. But I'm just curious, as you guys, you know, kind of explain the situation in your personal lives, what strategies do you employ? How do you approach people and kind of sit them down and talk to them about that history and relate it to what's going on today?
Go ahead.
Thanks, Kareem. So it really, you know, obviously the events of October 7th are very significant, but it's very important to understand and to know what has been happening for the last 75 years. Even the scene of tents, and people say, like, they see the scenes of people's in tents now. We just sort of, you know, we talk a little bit about how that in 1948, my grandmother was telling us the stories of how, you know, would be my father's cousin was shot dead in his bed because he simply had boots on. So they assumed that he was a soldier. And you hear those stories and you're like, you had to sort of were imagining them. But now it's almost like deja vu, like everything that they told us about, like the stories of how they struggled. Like my grandmother was telling us the story of how she struggled to get clean water to get her babies to drink while they were fleeing from their home. And she was talking about how this is actually kind of, you know, she's like a bit personal, but, you know, we tell people about how like she literally tried her pee and then urine. And she said that didn't taste good. And she wasn't going to give that to her children. And she had to find a different way. And luckily her aunt just happened to be also running and they crossed each other and had some water and give that to her kids. And then you fast forward 75 years, 77 years, and you look at this and you say, now people, I hear from, you know, you hear from them, you hear from your sisters, from your nieces, from your nephews, that they don't have clean water. They don't have what we call salt. You know, the only thing they have is salt water. It's almost like seawater. And so you basically educate people and say, you know, we've been through this before and we're in 2023 and we're going through it again. And the world has not been able to stop this. Like really, like what's going on here? Like, where is our humanity? So that sometimes opens their eyes a little bit more about, you know, that this situation has been happening, been going on for years, not just since October 7th.
Yeah, I've definitely come to understand the Nakba as an ongoing process, not a discrete event necessarily. It's got times of intensification, gross intensification, but it really never stopped in terms of the goals of the Zionist state. Kareem, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, we all struggle with this topic in terms of, you know, how to share such a story or even begin to describe devastation and what's going on. And we're also blessed here to have the safety and the security to be able to raise our children in safety and education and everything and opportunity. So when you come to describe it to somebody, sometimes it's very difficult to just wrap your head around the vast differences between two states. So unless a person's really ready for the conversation, sometimes you find it difficult to even mention. But I would say the most important thing is to understand that, yes, it's a complex issue at times because you think about the history there. But the reality is it's not so complex because the humanity aspect of it is all you really need to know. Nobody, you know, from our religion too, we're both Muslims. We do not stand for any innocent lives being killed from any side, right? the war and should never be in a situation where we are ever okay with innocent people dying. And we want to know, though, we want to make sure that people know that there's a stark difference between how people live in Gaza and the West Bank versus versus people that live in Israel, and what human rights they have, what state they're living in, the freedom of movement, the occupation, the apartheid. And those are things that to any human, I think you can relate to. And it's important to start with that, because the history you can learn over time, but the humanity aspect is ingrained in all of us. And that does not need a large education. Now, the more you do get educated with the topic, you realize this matter has been going on for decades, and it intensifies at certain times and cools down a little bit, intensifies some more, but it continues to get worse and worse for the Palestinians. And the world is standing by at times because of political interests, and we cannot continue to let that happen. And I think that's the key message we want to talk to everybody about.
Yeah. No, absolutely. At the event last night, the rally, we had a reporter talk to me for a moment, and she said something about a complex history and like how we're addressing that. And I think I touched on things, you know, just having conversations with people, trying to educate. But I said, the reality is, and I think this kind of piggybacks off your point, that when it comes to standing against genocide, that's an easy choice that we should all be able to make. So.
Right. And it's as simple as that at times. I mean, I think the counter argument to the Palestinians is, or anybody who's trying to stand up for the Palestinians, well, it's complex. You don't know the history. It's been like this for 2,000 years, and you know, and we have rights to the land. And they just basically put it in a situation where they shut people up, because unless you're a historian that understands the full 2,000 year history, you cannot speak up on the issue, and that's simply false. And we need to let everyone know, I think, that anybody can speak up on being a human being and saving innocent lives.
Yeah, I agree with that. So with that said, and I know you both touched on this in the intros, but can you share some, I know this is probably going to be difficult at some level, but can you share some experiences that you've heard from family members, again, just to kind of really emphasize that human aspect from people that you know and love, what they're going through, what they've endured over the past almost 100 days. And by extension, what are they calling for now? What are they demanding? What do they need from the global community?
I'll start. So I think to the short answer, the very short answer is that they're calling for a ceasefire. They really want to be able to just go to bed. Or in, there are probably no beds. Go on the ground, sleep under a tent, but just know or hope that an airstrike is not going to come in and kill them and their children while they're sleeping. That's the short answer. Like if I ask any of my siblings, and they literally, without even asking, they're just saying, this is all what we're asking for. We are not asking for anything. We're not asking for anything else other than a ceasefire. And then once you guys give us a ceasefire, then we can try to figure out what they lost. It's amazing how many people there during that brief ceasefire, just the amount of wounds that they discovered because they were shell-shocked and did not realize that so many other family members have been killed during the bombardment, because, you know, there is no news, there is no way to communicate. So for now, they're just asking for a ceasefire. Now, as far as their experiences there, I mean, I think, like, I can tell you personally, I've seen my nieces, my nephews, my siblings have lost. You barely can recognize them, honestly. They've lost so much weight. They're so stressed. You know, it's like they haven't slept in months. And they're honestly, they're like, when you speak with them, they're just saying, we're sick of waiting at this point. Like, you know, we know that our time is going to come up. So if we're going to die, we might as well die now. Like it's a very dark situation there. And I don't think there's any other war that we have ever observed or seen where a whole bunch of people are being bombed, but they're not allowed to leave. It's like you have them in a salt shaker and you're just shaking them and bombing them and not allowing them to go anywhere. Never in the history of the world have there been ever a group of people that have been bombed and not allowed to flee. And that is what we're having in Gaza.
Well said, Ahmed. We try to use analogies to describe the situation, but before I do, I would say, you think about the basic necessities and the needs. You know, we all quite often say that we need something, but we really want it. But what's really needed is food, water, shelter, and healthcare. The Gazan people right now don't have access to those necessities. 1.9 million out of 2.2 million people have lost their homes or been displaced out of their homes and are either living on the street, or if they can be lucky enough to have a tent, they live in a tent. But many of them are living on the street. There's no clean water. And when they do get any type of aid, it has to be rationed. When they get food, it has to be rationed. And there's days that go by where they don't get those things. It is devastating. And if anybody, God forbid, is injured, which has happened to many, the tens of thousands, there's no medical supplies to be able to support them or to heal them or to for amputations to be done without anesthesia is just horrifying. We cannot even become to imagine or come to imagine or describe the horror that they're living through. And what are people there on the ground are saying? They're saying, if we're going to die, we should might as well just finish it now. I mean, this is not a place that can live. It feels like hell. And that seems to be the intention of the Israeli army, to put those people in those positions. It has become very clear. I mean, it's been like this clear to Gazans all their lives, but it's clear to the international community that they're not going after Hamas. They're going after the people. They want to make it inhabitable. They want to make them flee. They're hoping that Egypt is going to open up the border and absorb and take all these Palestinians into their country. And then just eventually get it to the point where they can take it over. And it's so heart-wrenching and heartbreaking to see that.
You know, the kind of choices that people have to make there right now, like to choose literally like the stories you hear where a friend of ours sent us a message last night, and he said, and this is a gentleman who is a college professor, who is a journalist. One of the affluential person there, right? And he's saying literally they were sick and they went to the clinic, but they didn't have enough medication to treat all three of them. It was him, his wife, and his son. So they had to choose which person gets treated. Like, how is that acceptable? Like, how is that even in this day and age can happen in a place on this earth? And so you hear, like, day after day, you hear stories from families about making, we talk here about difficult choices that we have to make in our life, but consider making choices which one of your kids get to stay alive and when which one not doesn't get treatment. Like, these are kind of choices that those people have to make. It's a very dire situation.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's complete tragedy on a human level. And Ahmed, you made a point about how we've never seen a nation of people basically being interned in a concentration camp and bombed indiscriminately. I do think this is so unique in history because we are actually seeing it and observing it and getting some of the stories back in real time. And it is, I think, changing the international perspective on the situation a bit. I mean, I want to turn to, I guess, maybe U.S. politics a little bit, but on a note of optimism, and I guess I want to hear what y'all's thoughts are on this. But given that we have this documented evidence of war crimes, the suffering of Palestinian people, and broadcasted statements, genocidal statements by Israeli ministers, members of Knesset, et cetera, the president and the prime minister. South Africa has compiled all of this evidence and charged Israel with genocide at the International Court of Justice. It's being supported by several other countries, such as Jordan and Bolivia. And we know that the ICJ is limited in what it can actually do in terms of implementing any punitive measures resulting from a judgment. But are you guys seeing any optimism in this development, given that Israel has shown no restraints and has no regard for humanity?
If I may, Ahmed, I'll comment on that first. But it's hard to find optimism. Every time an action is taken, the Zionist movement and the control on media finds a narrative to take what is said or what actions are being taken and manipulate them to their benefit. We, of course, are hopeful in a sense that if people continue to speak up and there's enough people that continue to speak up, that would actually make a difference. The International Criminal Court at least will get international coverage and hopefully bring to light to those that haven't seen the devastation and the truth about what's going on in terms of the genocidal intent of Israel against the Palestinian people, that it would actually bring those to light with proof. And that can make a big difference. In my opinion, if more people know and stop listening to the Zionist-controlled mainstream media, we can have a chance at getting people to realize who they can support for in terms of our elected officials, understand what kind of pressure and demands they can make to end this genocide, and the clear genocidal intent that they have of just forcibly displacing Palestinians or killing them with genocide, with the intent of genocide, as long as they end up with that land. That's the Zionist agenda. So with that being said, the more exposure that's out there putting these particular points out there to the international community is putting us with some hopeful aspirations here over the next little while. So I would say that there's some positive to come from this, some positive points. But we know that the mainstream media will be definitely making attempts to change the narrative that comes out of this.
It's definitely, I would say, thank you, Karim. I think you're spot on. And I think you and I, just even from our own life experiences here in the U.S. and speaking with folks, I can tell you that the people of Pittsburgh are some of the most genuine people that I've ever met in my life. And I know this for a fact, that every time I have a conversation with somebody, you know, we still have this sort of like our blue collar type of like pureness to us, where like, you know, they don't sugarcoat anything. They're just straight folks. Like, you know, they say it as it is. And every time I have a conversation with anybody from Pittsburgh and sort of just, you know, give them or explain to them what's really happening out there and just make them aware, they literally act with complete shock. Like I really did not know that that's what's going on. We did not know, we're so sorry for what's happening. What can we do to help? So it's like the more and more people that know about what's happening in Gaza and in Palestine in general, the more support this movement that is asking for peace will get traction. And the more folks that will go, and like Karim said, will demand from our elected official to be balanced in our response to this conflict. I don't think any Palestinian is asking any elected official to sort of take sides one over the other. It's simply be that leader of the free world and actually be balanced. Because when we are balanced, when we go in there with the goal of putting peace in there, we will be able to find a solution. The really sad part is that all of this awareness that we're seeing now and international awareness in all these countries is coming at such a steep cost, huge expensive cost, that the loss of life, all the all the kids that lost their limbs, you know, the number of injured people, the destruction of almost 90% of infrastructure, houses, everything that is, what is Gaza? Like you can't recognize it really. Like there's nothing left. It's a very huge cost, but at least people are learning and becoming more aware. So whatever happens, and hopefully we get an ending to this war soon, all of this awareness should mean that we can't go back to the status quo. We can't go back to another 75 years of occupation and another genocide and another genocide. This should be the start of a new era where the Palestinian people can overcome their oppression and actually get a chance to live free and live safely. And I think that's what I'm hoping and praying for.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, obviously the immediate need just for the sake of humanity is a ceasefire. But to your point, we can't go back to a situation where we've got a rebuilt Gaza surrounded by barbed wire and fences with access in and out controlled. That's just going to lead to another breakout of this. We cannot have an apartheid occupation any longer after this. You both touched on something that I think is important in terms of the political movements here. So from your perspective, I have a couple questions related to this. Where do you think the mass movement in the U.S. streets needs to go to be more effective? And I guess relatedly, and I don't want to essentialize your perspectives on this necessarily, but I'm assuming you do have some insight. But what is your sense for the Arab and Muslim communities' attitude towards the Biden administration? I mean, they have been among some of our senators locally here and representatives unflinching in their support for Israel's assault, genocidal assault on Gaza. And as of tonight, it looks like they're going to begin bombing Yemen again, who have actually stood up and fought against genocide in the Red Sea. So again, where does the movement need to go? And I guess from the Arab Muslim community, where are you seeing this going this year?
Karim, you're involved in this a lot more than I am, so.
Sure. I would say we can look back, you know, the Arab and the Muslim community in general stood at one point to help get Biden elected due to the Islamophobic policies and clear, open rhetoric from the Trump administration against Islam. That was taken so far to the point that he created what was known as the Muslim ban against multiple countries that were predominantly Muslim to enter into the U.S. This is one of the most racist items or agenda items that have been seen openly put into office that we've seen in a very long time. When Biden was trying to get elected into office, he was clear in saying that he would fight for all people, that he does not have a racist agenda. He treats everybody equally. And with that being said, won the hearts and minds of many people that were feeling that they were being marginalized in the community. We fast forward a few years and this war breaks out. And we realize quickly that all that rhetoric was simply to get elected. We know where his alliances stand now. It's open. It's been in the public. There's nowhere to hide from it. It's as clear as day. His alliances are with Israel. His alliances are with AIPAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Council. They get funded from AIPAC, and the agenda for Israel is quite strong, to the point that Palestinians' lives, regardless of how many are lost, are not as important as Israeli lives. It is very clear. And at that point, it puts a lot of the Muslim population here in the U.S. and Arab population in a situation where they're looking at a candidate that's flat out lied about that policy. There's also a growing sense of activism because of that. And it's, as myself, as an American Palestinian, I care about this country more than, you know, my kids are born here. They're going to be living here all their lives. We want this country to thrive. We understand international policy and the need for the U.S. to protect itself. But as an American, I cannot sit here and say that I'm proud with the policies that are being taken, regardless whether I'm Palestinian or not. And a very big point and example that we have to state is that there's over 30 states right now that have policies in place that show proof of the allyship towards Israel stronger than it is for any other country in the world. And right now, you can't even get government funding or support in certain states unless you sign a document that specifically says you cannot boycott Israel. You cannot criticize Israel. But here, we can criticize America, and we can criticize and we can boycott American things and any other country for that matter, except for Israel. What kind of message does that show for, is that sending for everybody? This whole idea of unwavering support and to Israel, regardless of what they do, is that really what this country has become? This is the least American thing that I can think of. And in a matter of fact, against our constitution, we need to be able to be living in a country where people can live together in peace, regardless of your background, regardless of your religion, as long as you are a good law-abiding citizen. And we have compromised that. We compromised our own constitution for the sake of political interests. And that is a new low. And we, as the nation, as the people of this nation, have the absolute obligation to speak up when things go to that low. We have a history in this country of oppression, of people here. We have a civil rights movement where we were fighting each other at some point, just to do what's right, to be on the right side of history. We have that same obligation to us right now. We have to be on the right side of history. And the people of this country, including Pittsburghers, who are some of the most amazing people that I've ever met. And I've, like I said, I'm an international, so I've seen a lot of places. Pittsburghers are honest. They're faithful people. And they know when things are not right. And I do have faith that we will all come together and be on the right side of history. Thank you for that, Nick. But I just, that's how I feel about it.
No, and I think you touched on something critically important, and just want to get this in before I hand it over to you, Ahmed, to add anything that you've got. But just as a generalization, if you look at the history of this country, like you said, we do have a history of oppression, especially around marginalized groups. But the thing that has turned that have been the movements of people, organized people on the ground demanding. Nothing was ever handed down by some great man. FDR didn't just hand down the New Deal. Lyndon Baines Johnson didn't just hand down the Civil Rights Act. Those were demanded by organized mass movements of people, multiracial, multi-ethnic on the ground. So that was just, I think, a really crucial point that you had there, Kareem.
Thank you, Nick.
Absolutely. And we won't be able to speak for all, all the Muslim Americans or all the Arab Americans in the U.S., but the sentiment that we're seeing from folks is a whole lot of disappointment, I remember I voted for Biden, President Biden, and I remember when folks asked me, I said, I voted in a single issue. And they said, what was that single issue? And I said that President Trump, when he was in office, he cut the funding for UNRWA. So he was, UNRWA schools where students can find some decent shelter away from all the violence and all the fear around them. He's being able to go to a small, peaceful place and just study and hope to be somebody sometime, right? So one day, right? When President Trump came in office, he cut that funding. So it was $250 million or something like that. President Biden ran on the fact that he was going to restore that funding, and he did. So I was happy with him, until what happened recently, where he completely turned his back on humanity. We saw him speak in the church last week and talk, or it might have been this week, about humanity and about light, and yet completely ignoring the fact that over 12,000 Palestinian children have been killed. And he has the ability to stop that and did not stop that. As far as the, as our elected officials, see, you can't have selective humanity. So you either are for humanity or against it. You cannot say that I am for humanity and then see children suffering and dying and stand without doing anything to stop that. So I think this year election cycle is going to be a sort of like a statement regarding what has happened so far. And we all have to make some difficult decisions, including the possibility of getting Trump back in office, knowing wholeheartedly that he wants to restore the Muslim ban, but at least to send a clear message that our votes can't be taken for granted, and that we need to stand together as a collective. If we say that we're progressive, if we say that we are a movement where we welcome everyone and we don't discriminate against anybody based on their religion, faith, background, or heritage, that everybody in the world has the right to live free, then we need to stand true to that statement and not be selective on when we apply it and when we don't apply it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think there's a lot of people that are going to make the correct or take the correct stance that funding a genocide has to be a red line. Like you can't do that and keep my support. You know, on the optimistic side, I think we've talked a lot about, you know, the movements here and connecting people. You know, so what I look forward to is people that want something better are going to demand something better from, you know, whether that's like the Arab Muslim community here locally, to just progressive organizers, to the labor movement, such that we can actually wield our power as people. And I think that's going to be crucial. You know, again, I don't think that, to the point about the Palestinians can't go back to normal, I think we here in the U.S. can't go back to normal after this. We can't just accept this idea of, okay, everything is distilled down to basically voting between these two monsters on the political level here. You know, we need to be able to do better than this, I think. But I am optimistic on the side of all these connections that we're making here and just learning from each other and brainstorming about what we can do more together. So relatedly, and maybe shifting gears a tiny bit, but at a recent meeting the three of us attended, I think you both mentioned the importance of humanizing Palestinians, and that's been a theme of this conversation tonight. And I think so much of what we're seeing go on right now in terms of the consent that was manufactured for it relies on years of Orientalism, propaganda, and demonization of not just Palestinians, but especially Palestinians, but like the Arab and Muslim worlds broadly. So what do you want to say to our audience in this regard, and how do we go about creating a culture which cherishes Palestinian life and its beautiful traditions, like right here in Pittsburgh?
So, Karim, I don't know if you want to go first.
Please go ahead.
Okay, so honestly, I the way I look at it is this, and you know, referencing the meeting or referencing, you know, some of the events that we've been together, I feel like, if you look at the folks who are coming out to speak against this genocide, the folks who are coming out to speak for the humanity of the Palestinians are such a diverse crowd. It is so beautiful, like, you know, very colorful, right? Very, it's like literally a cross section of our people here in the US. And that is what the beauty about it is, the fact that it is bringing people together. And you know, when you're coming together for a cause, it is a good cause. And when all of our hearts are bleeding for the suffering of the people in Gaza, we have accomplished the goal of humanizing the Palestinians, because, you know, when the Holocaust happened, one of the biggest things that was happening before the Holocaust was how the Nazis were dehumanizing the Jewish people. And that propaganda that you would think that nobody in this world will ever do something that horrible, have made it so that it was okay for the Nazis to do what they did to the Jewish people there. And we saw the same thing, the same propaganda talking about the Palestinians and, you know, making us look like villains, talking about beheaded babies, talking about unfounded claims about all of these different claims and lies that came out in the first week, to make it so that it would be okay to go ahead and bomb the people of Gaza, so because they've committed all of these atrocities, when in reality, people quickly realize that this is another propaganda. And then once they were able to see that, they're able to see the humanity of the Palestinian people, that they bleed the same way we bleed, that they love their kids as much as we loved our kids, that they actually, all they're asking for, like Kareem said, all they're asking for is literally food, water, shelter, and perhaps internet, but cutting them off from the world. Like, it's such a horrible situation. And people are able to say, you know what, I see those folks. And it's amazing how the responses from people that otherwise I would never have expected them to be commenting on the conflict, looking at this and saying, I've seen kids being pulled out of the rubble that look like my kids. And I don't understand why we're not stopping this. So I feel like we've accomplished, despite all the efforts, and Kareem was very thoughtful in explaining how the media has done a lot of heavy lifting trying to change the narrative. But despite all of these efforts, people are still looking and saying, you know what? We know the Palestinians. We've had their food. We ate together. We laughed together. We went and worked together for other causes, and we supported each other. And we know for a fact that those Palestinians are as humane, as a human, as anybody else. You know, we need to stand up and help them overcome and stop this genocide. So that gives me hope.
Well said, Ahmed. Thank you for that. There's my point here to add to that would be mainly, how do you dehumanize a nation? How do you dehumanize them? Is to list them as a threat, paint them with a particular brush. The term that's quite often used is the term terrorism and the terrorists behind the threats that are being posed in this war. And the problem with that is, as soon as you label one party terrorists and the other party freedom fighters, and ones that are currently fighting for the world to rid them of these terrorists, is essentially you're giving a blank check and the go-ahead for this army to commit what's now being called openly an international war crime of genocide. It is important for us to note, too, that the position as an American, the position of the U.S. in support of Israel is enabling these war crimes. The support of the media to spread these lies is enabling these war crimes. And it is important as Americans to wake up and let everybody know that, yeah, we understand international political interests and so on and so forth, but not at the cost of international war crimes. Ahmed brought up a very good point about the Holocaust. The Holocaust happened because of an entire race being painted with the brush, with one brush, and labeled as a cancer to society, as terrorists, and the world must rid of them. After that Holocaust, international law against war crimes was put in place specifically to never let that happen again. The Holocaust, that's what's remembered from that, is a very important statement, and it's simply saying never again, and never again for all people. No nation and no people should ever have to face a genocide. This is a direct result of media propaganda and a direct result of policies that support what's going on over there right now. And hence, we need to take action and recognize that we need to do something about this as soon as possible before it gets any worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a good place to start to look to wrap up. But the final thing that I had for you guys is, you know, I think you've both mentioned that we're finding hope, growing movements here where people are seeing humanity. But I want to speak to, you know, one, how can people get involved right now? And what can people do looking to the future in a free Palestine to help rebuild?
Ahmed, do you want to go?
Go ahead, Karim. Please.
Okay. There is inherent fear in people's hearts and minds to speak up. There's fear from all kinds of places. One being, I don't know enough about this topic to speak up about it. The other is, well, I don't know if I'll be judged if I speak up. And specifically for Muslims and Arabs and Palestinians is, will I lose my job? Will I be painted as a terrorist supporter? These are all real fears, because I know a predominant, as in more than 50%, predominant number of people that I speak with consider these factors before they even say one word against Israel, knowing full well how much support is there is for Israel and its policies here from the US. The political interests, the business interests, the capital that's being put into businesses. And this is the realistic matter that we're dealing with. I also take that into consideration because of the fear that's out there and the retaliation that's done from real doxing that happens to people that speak up. But they're not capable of doing that anymore. Doxing can only happen with a select group of people, maybe a handful, maybe a few hundred. But with the hundreds of thousands and millions of people all across the world that are speaking up right now, we need every single voice to speak up for humanity. And this is the time. If you need to reach out to your elected officials and let them know how disappointed you are in their position if they haven't already called for a ceasefire and an end to the occupation. If you're not hearing it from the media, reach out to the media and say, why are you just showing one side of the equation and not the other? If you're hearing it from your friends and your neighbors, please share your perspective as well and educate everybody that's around you. We can do a lot with our voices here in the US. It is the US, our country, America, that is enabling these war crimes to continue. And my call would be to speak up without the fear. And it's time. This is the time.
Thank you, Karim. That's exactly, I think that's probably sums up all the different challenges for someone to speak up. But at the same time, in addition to the folks that can speak up and not speaking up, we have a whole other, you know, group of folks who I wouldn't say they don't care, but they're maybe not aware, right? Or they're so busy in their lives that they're not able to realize or recognize that this is happening. And for those folks, you know, I feel like part of our outreach should be, you know, if you're somebody that knows what's going on, knows what's happening, knows about the suffering of the children of Gaza, is to spread the word and to educate others whether that going out to your local community center, going out to your local church, your local synagogue, your local mosque, your local libraries, just being able to speak up about the topic and share it, because we should all care. This is important, not just for Palestinians or folks who believe that the Palestinian people should, you know, live in peace. This is an important topic for anybody that believes that oppression is not the right thing, that believes in humanity, believes in peace. And it's very important for people that believe that, you know what, we have so many problems in our country that needs to be solved, that we should not be getting engaged in spending billions and billions of dollars on weapon and war when we could save a lot of lives here in the U.S. And I want to share this stat because I read this article right in the midst of everything that was happening in Gaza, and it just shook my core, because I know that most of us know at least a family member or an extended family member here in the U.S. that lost their lives because of mental health issues. People, and the number is, and this is like a really scary number, 50,000 people have committed suicide in the U.S. in the year 2023. 50,000 people. And to think that if we switched our efforts and our resources to help in some of these dire needs that we have here in the U.S., not only would we not have 26,000 Palestinians dead in Gaza, perhaps we could have saved another 26,000 Americans here on our soil by focusing and shifting those resources to much better causes than war and fighting.
Yes, absolutely. That's an incredible connection to draw, because our expenditures are making lives worse for people across the globe as life deteriorates right here at home. As I said earlier, I believe that we can do better than this. Karim, to your point about speaking out, you know, I would just add to that, you know, it can feel isolating, but I would say, you know, go out and seek organization. You know, obviously I'm here with PSL, but we're part of a beautiful coalition of other organizations like BDS, SJP, JVP, some of the Muslim organizations and activists in the community, and just committed individuals to this task. So if you are feeling politically isolated, I mean, seek out organization. I mean, that just from that perspective, I think can really help you feel like you can be heard and give you the power and the education and the confidence to go out and speak to this in other places of your life as well. At least for me, that is something that just the power of community has really given me a lot of grounding on this issue. And I think we can together provide that for other people as well.
That's a great point that you mentioned, Nick. I appreciate it. And I just want to remind everybody that, you know, part of the beauty of this country is that freedom of speech, and we do get the opportunity to speak up on matters, and we can do it in such a way that, you know, in peaceful protests. And anyone who thinks, I mean, I understand there's a lot of emotions out there on this topic, and people are really feeling the need to take action now. But the most important thing is that we continue to make our voices heard and to do it in the most peaceful way possible. You know, I appreciate all the work that you're doing too, Nick, and to get people educated out there as well. So certainly appreciate that.
And I'm just one of many. So it's a collective effort, absolutely, that we're all a part of.
It's an amazing, amazing group of people from different backgrounds of faith and cultures and beliefs. And that's what's very important and beautiful about the group of people who are speaking for the Palestinian people. Like even the food that we share, and you know, it's such a beautiful community. And it is obviously sad that we're coming together for what's happening in Gaza, but you know, our dream is that we continue to support each other and continue to grow stronger with each other, because that's what, you know, how America was founded. It was founded on, you know, basically being able to support each other and support the communities around you, versus what, you know, a lot of folks are trying to do is to divide us and to put us into different categories and check boxes, and that is not who we are. We're all human, and we're all looking for peace. And peaceful protests is what we're looking for. You know, ending the genocide, calling for a ceasefire is what we're dreaming of and what we're shooting for and what we're asking our elected officials to provide. And, you know, thank you so much for all the work that you guys have been doing. Thank you for everyone that, like you guys said, have braved the cold and went out and started speaking on behalf of the Palestinian people. And, you know, it's a little bit of discomfort for us, but we just imagine and know about all the suffering that they're going through and how minuscule everything that we're going through here compares to what they're going through.
Yeah. No, that is the sobering reality at the end of the day. And that's the reason to go out and fight for humanity. On the positive side, I do feel very blessed to have met and be working with folks like yourselves. As you said, it's a great crew of people. And I know that after we have a ceasefire and a free Palestine, we're going to continue to be friends and comrades and work together on all the important issues facing us. So with that said, I'm going to look to wrap up here. Before I let you guys go, I just do want to announce a few upcoming events. I think by the time this comes out, we'll have missed the January 13th March on Washington will have already come and gone. So hopefully we're talking about a amazing turnout down the line on that. In Pittsburgh here, we are planning a rally and a speak out at Chris DeLuzio's office in Penn Hills on the 20th. Go out and make our voices heard together as a community there. On the education side, I know BDS has a film viewing coming up with PSL. We're working with SJP to put on a reading group study series on Ghassan Kanafani's Palestinian Revolution of 36 to 39. Those are going to be happening on the 27th and the 3rd at Pitt, among a number of other events. Again, come out, find community, make your voices heard. Follow us on all our socials. There's BDS, the Pittsburgh Palestine Solidarity Committee, PSL, among many others. So find us. You can find all our events and get connected. But Kareem, Ahmed, just want to thank you so much for coming on tonight, sharing your stories. Just we wish all the best for your families. And we're going to keep pushing for a ceasefire here. And again, a free Palestine. So thank you again so much.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you for having
Absolutely.
Us.
Thank you so much, Nick. Thank you, Kareem, for sharing space with us.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Take care.
And for the listeners, thank you for listening. We'll see you out on the streets in Free Palestine.
Free Palestine.